Welcome to another episode of Yashoda Health Podcast, your trusted source for valuable health information. I'm your host, Dr. Lakshmi, and today we are going to discuss a life-saving procedure, liver transplantation. Joining us today is Dr. Dharmesh Kapoor, Senior Consultant Hepatologist. Dr. Dharmesh Kapoor, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So to start a discussion, could you provide our listeners with an overview of liver transplantation? And what are the main reasons someone might need a liver transplant?
So I think that's a wonderful question, because most of the patients with liver disease who come to a tertiary referral center like ours have been to practicing physicians or gastroenterologists in the community. And when they are diagnosed with liver disease, it's oftentimes their primary care provider who tells them that now this liver disease has gone beyond the paradigm of regular medical management and that they might be now evaluable for a liver transplant. So broadly speaking, liver transplant is done for patients with advanced liver disease, which we also call decompensated chronic liver disease. And these are the patients who've got a difficult to treat ascites, difficult to treat GI bleed, or they get recurrent episodes of abnormal mentation or cognition, which is called recurrent or persistent hepatic encephalopathy. And very, very commonly in recent times, we've been seeing cirrhosis patients who come back to us only with recurrent infections. So bacterial and other infections are also a very common indication for somebody to be referred for liver transplant. So this is one basket of patients who would need liver transplant. The second basket of patients who would need liver transplant is those who are diagnosed with liver cancer. And we find that the cancer burden in the liver is such that it's probably not manageable by the quasi or posse invasive techniques like loco-regional therapy. Or we feel that this patient has got a disease which might not be amenable to these measures, what we call as liver-directed therapy, which is commonly seen when you have disease in both lobes of the liver. So either you cannot burn the tumor or put medicine into the tumor, or resect, which means remove that tumor with a part of the healthy liver. So these are again candidates who would need liver transplant. So roughly speaking, about 15 to 20% of all HCCs are offered liver transplant. Some of these patients might need what we call as a downstaging procedure. That means the tumor burden is high at the outset. We give them some liver-directed therapy and then they fall within the acceptable criteria for liver transplantation. And the third basket, which is now a growing basket for us, are the patients who present suddenly like a bolt out of the blue with liver failure and extrahepatic organ failures. So these are patients with the acute on chronic liver failure. So these are patients who have hitherto diagnosed or undiagnosed chronic liver disease. And when there is a superimposed insult to this liver fails along with other organs. So this particular entity is now constituting at least 30 to 40% of transplant activity across mature transplant centers in the country. So these, broadly speaking, are the three baskets of patients that we do liver transplants for.
So what is the process for someone in need of a liver transplant? Can you walk us through the entire process from evaluation to surgery to recovery?
So as we are aware that there are two kinds of liver transplant. One is a deceased donor liver transplant, wherein someone who's very sick and the kind of patient that I just described a little while ago gets an offer of a brain dead donor liver. The second modality of transplanting people is when a family member donates a part of the liver, and that is called the living donor liver transplant. The recipient evaluation, that means someone in whom you are going to place the new liver, remains pretty much the same for both these two categories of liver transplant. So in the recipient evaluation, the most important evaluation is of the heart and lung. So even though the patient is having an underlying liver disease, but these two organs are vital for us to be able to do a liver transplant successfully. And this happens because of the huge number of changes which happen with respect to the ventilation, their fluid shifts, hemodynamics, intraoperatively. So anybody who does not have a heart or a lung that is going to hold out, they would not have a successful outcome after transplant, even if you transplant them with an excellent organ. Other components of the evaluation are also extremely important, but not as important as the cardiopulmonary assessment. So these are assessment of the renal function, make sure that your patient is not having any active infection. And in the challenging cohort of acute and chronic liver failure that I alluded to a little while ago, this becomes a huge onus on the treating team to make sure that this patient is not harboring any active infection, because many of these patients are transplanted from the ICU rather than the floors or the community. So renal function, assessment of infections, then the general things which would be needed, which will have a bearing on how this patient is going to perform after transplant. So this is a correct assessment of their viral status. And here we are not talking of just the hepatitis B and hepatitis C virus, but also of the immunodeficiency viruses and certain viruses which are very peculiar to solid organ transplant, which are basically cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus. You'd run a complete gamut of metabolic assessment on them so that you make sure that the thyroid hormone function or status is good, that there isn't diabetes that would need special attention, that there is any iron overload that is going to need special attention, and so on and so forth. So these are set protocols which we designed some 2.5 decades ago and which have stood the test of time. So this is with respect to the recipient evaluation. Now coming to the donor evaluation. So we should understand that when somebody is brain dead and their family agrees in a very benevolent manner to donate the organs of this particular individual, it's like a God's gift to the recipient and to the transplant community. And these particular donors, we might not always have a very good idea about their past medical history, because many of them might be road traffic accidents, but they will have to be evaluated at least to some extent by way of bedside imaging, viral markers, and assessment of their biochemical tests. When it comes to a living donor liver transplant, the evaluation of the donor is very, very stringent, and in certain respects even more stringent than the recipient for which that donor is donating the liver. So this donor also undergoes the entire gamut of tests of liver function, metabolic profile, and we have to do special tests to be able to be certain that we will be able to remove a part of this liver without jeopardizing the health of the donor. So this donor would be subjected to what is called as liver attenuation index assessment, that gives you an idea about the fat in the liver. This donor will be subjected to CT volumetry to know the total volume of this liver, the anatomical details of this liver so that you can perform the surgery safely, and then also delineation of the biliary anatomy through an MRCP so that we know that you would be able to divide the bile duct in a manner that would not harm the donor and that would provide a graft with a good draining bile duct for the recipient. So these are the various tests. In a very broad stroke, I've tried to paint them for the recipient as well as the donor.
So donor organs are crucial for liver transplantation. Can you explain how organ donation works in the context of liver transplantation? And what are the challenges and considerations involved in finding a suitable donor?
So I think the bulk of the transplants that happen in our country are still happening the living donor way. That means a family member donates a part of the liver to the recipient, who generally is a relative only of the donor. And then, like I outlined a little while ago, the various tests that this donor would be subjected to. So when you are performing living donor liver transplant, the responsibility on the transplant team is enormous. Over here, there is an equipoise that the donor should not come to any kind of harm, and the recipient also should stand to get benefited. So this is very tricky, not just for medical reasons, but also ethical reasons. At times when you have a very sick patient with you, there is often a tendency for the treating team to are on the side of recipient benefit, and in the process, at times not be very stringent with the donor benefit. So I think this is something that any mature transplant program should refrain from doing. So it's always the donor safety first. And that has been our motto ever since we've been doing transplants, which is now about 2.5 decades. So this is with respect to the living donor transplant. When it comes to the deceased donor transplant, these are transplants which generally happen for very, very sick patients, because I must tell our listeners over here that when patients are extremely sick, the bar for a living donation, it keeps going up higher. That means you would have a very high threshold for accepting a living donor for this particular very sick patient. Because at the end of the day, when someone is very sick, greater the quantum or magnitude of sickness, more is the liver mass that this patient is going to need in the surgery and in the immediate post-operative period to have a fruitful outcome. And at the end of the day, you cannot draw any amount of volume from a prospective donor. So therefore, when somebody is very sick, and for the kind of patients I described a little while ago, those who get transplanted from the ICU, those who are on multiple organ supports, at least in our program, it's always been the preferred way to transplant them, the deceased donor way. Now, when it comes to the deceased donor evaluation, I already briefly mentioned about that, but the real challenge lies in the numbers. So even in a country like the United States, where about 7,500 transplants happen every year on an annual basis, there are about 1,500 to 2,000 patients who need a liver and who die while on the waiting list. The numbers are even more staggering for our country, and therefore the reliance on living donor transplant in various parts of the country. We in our group are extremely fortunate because we have got many units in the city, and we have got a very vibrant neurology neurosurgery service, and which is very supportive of the transplant activity in our program. And therefore, some of the very, very sick patients who get declined transplantation in other parts of the country, they come to our program, and we take pride in the fact that we are able to offer transplants for these patients. So the challenge has always been a timely donation. So like I said, when you have high acuity patients, these patients will have what we call as the golden window of opportunity in which you must transplant them, which is actually the time frame when you have been able to optimize them after their primary liver intensive care. And then if you are able to transplant them, you will get results as good as you would get in a patient who's not so sick. But for that to happen, that donation must come your way in a timely manner. So long story short, you have to have timely donations, and the donations, the waiting list numbers are again staggering. In any blood group that you talk about, you will have a number of patients who are extremely sick, who have got high MELD scores, who got high organ failure scores, and who are vying for the same organ that might come the program's way. So the real challenge lies in having more and more people to come forward and donate, and I hope through this message which goes out to the community, more and more people would feel inclined to donate their organs, because we alone know that this one particular donor can save so many lives.
And also, recovery after a liver transplant can be challenging. So what are some key factors that contribute to a successful recovery, and what support is available for patients?
The post-transplant care of these patients would basically depend on how sick they were going into transplant. So as you know, all patients, and for this is true for all solid organ transplants and not just liver transplant, patients would need immunosuppression. So human beings do not accept foreign tissues in their system. So the initial response of the host is to reject this tissue. And for us to be able to prevent that, this process of providing immunosuppression actually starts in the operating room. And then this continues in a phased manner in the post-operative period. So you need a lot of maturity and experience of having transplanted successfully a number of these patients to be able to wrap your head around the need for immunosuppression in various cohorts of patients that I described a little while ago. So someone who's not very sick going into transplant, say for the HCC indication, would need more immunosuppression starting in the immediate post-operative period. However, there is a caveat that they would need the kind of immunosuppression which would mitigate tumor formation in the new liver. Those who are very sick and who get transplanted from the ICU, you have to be more nuanced in your approach of immunosuppression. So less immunosuppression at the beginning. The moment they get weaned off their organ supports, suddenly there would be a surge in the body's response against this new organ, and you would land up with the rejection. And therefore, you have to have a balance between the amount of immunosuppression which would prevent rejection and not allow sepsis to come to the fore. And as time passes by and the body or the host starts to accept this organ, the amount of immunosuppression switches from parenteral, which means something which is pushed into your veins, to oral. And by the time the patients get discharged, they would virtually be on all oral immunosuppression. Once they go out to the community, you have to counsel your patients with respect to personal hygiene, with respect to the timing of their immunosuppression, and with respect to their follow-ups. The family members need to be counseled too, so that when there are any alarm signs or red flags, the patient can be brought back to the primary transplant unit. But as time passes by, the amount of immunosuppression that you would give to a given patient who's undergone a solid organ transplant keeps diminishing. So our ultimate aim is that the body should be able to accept this organ with the least amount of immunosuppression. Now, what happens in the medium to long term for these patients. These are all complications which the immunosuppression can produce. So your job does not finish just by transplanting a patient successfully and sending him out to the community. Your job is an ongoing process. So as time passes by, the solid organ transplant recipients, they start to suffer by way of the metabolic complications of immunosuppression or the presence of a new malignancy, which is again being produced by this immunosuppression. So we should all realize that when you are suppressing a host's immunity, obviously your surveillance against cancer also declines. So if you want to improve the medium to long-term outcomes of our transplant recipients, then you need to have a very, very balanced approach on immunosuppression.
Thank you, Dr. Dharmesh Kapoor, for sharing your expertise on liver transplant and the life-saving impact it can have for patients in need. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Remember that while liver transplantation provides hope for those with severe liver disease, it also emphasizes the importance of organ donation. Stay informed, stay proactive, and take care of your health. Thank you.